Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Jamaica Kincaid. We're talking about her new book, My Garden, parentheses, book, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Jamaica Kincaid came to Los Angeles to speak at the Los Angeles Art Museum's Institute for Arts and Cultures, and I thought it would be a good time to talk about the mixture of art and culturing that goes into the garden book. Insofar as we have such a thing, Jamaica is something of a regular on the program now, and it's a pleasure to see you again.
Thank you.
I wanted immediately to ask about the opening piece, Wisteria. When was it written?
Perhaps a year ago. So we're in 1999. Yeah, perhaps a little more than a year ago when the wisteria started to bloom way out of its season. And it led to this all the perplexing things that had happened to me in the garden. It spurred a memory of all of them. And lo and behold, this year it really did do that again, bloom way out of season, and even later than last year. But I thought that perhaps that was because the weather was so odd this year.
Because, you know, it's an absolutely beautiful piece.
Oh, thank you very much.
I don't think it's been published before, so
no.
I guess you haven't had response to it.
No.
But immediately upon reading it, well, you'll pardon this expression, it's probably awkward, I couldn't wait to get my tongue wrapped around it, and I took it to a friend's house and said, put down everything, and I know that you're going to think that this is the kind of writing, you know, they're the kind of people who wouldn't like to read descriptions in novels, I think. They're not novel readers. So you may feel that this is the kind of writing that you'd skip over if you were reading, but listen to this. And I read the whole piece to them, and they were astonished.
Really?
Oh, it's an absolutely beautiful, a quintessential piece.
And you're very kind. Thank you.
I thought it really was an advance over really anything you'd done of that kind before, because it really, you know, if, as we've said again and again before, if your work is about inhabiting two worlds at once,
yes,
pitting them against each other, rejecting them, accepting them, opposing them, this moves beyond that to an odd perspective that displeasure is one of the pleasures of life, and as you say at the end of the new book, My Garden Book, I take a pleasure in displeasure, and I want to share that pleasure.
You know. Oh, gosh, I must say, I'm a little frightened. Always I'm a little frightened to talk to you, Michael, because you always tell me things that I hope only I know about my writing. So it's a little bit frightening. But I think one of the things about writing, for me anyway, about the garden was it gave me an opportunity. I hope I've taken the opportunity to do things in writing that I can't do or haven't been able to do when I write about a specific thing that I understand, a certain specific reality, historical reality, my own existence. When I'm in the garden, all sorts of things that are not really what I would ordinarily write about come in. And I wouldn't know what to do with the thoughts about the wisteria and the thoughts about being alive and having a garden and how observations about the world. I wouldn't know what to do with them really in the narrow structure I write. But since I am in the garden, I can just do a lot of things. And so I suppose that's what did happen. And I'm really amazed that it comes across. I never think that anybody will understand anything I write, but I mean, that wouldn't stop me from writing it.
Now, once again, the garden leads you into the world, and the world leads you into the garden. Gradually in this book, we see that for Jamaica Kincaid, to have a garden means to have plants from all over the world.
Yes.
By the end of the book, the ability of these plants to be together in what you call a wild garden represents the world in which one of everything would be ideally and potentially side by side.
Yes.
But there are many people who either do not understand the wild garden, as you educed by a quotation from the man who perfected the first wild garden in England,
yes,
do not want a wild garden or find a wild garden merely to be a variant on the picturesque.
Yes.
So the garden in this book becomes, what is that word, a synecdoche? for the vast problem,
yes,
of the world and its differences.
Yes. Well, it occurred to me, I was in China with these seed collectors, these really brilliant plants people, nursery men and women. Well, one woman anyway. And we were tramping through forests of rhododendron and iris and primulas, all sorts of things, you know, that are treasured in the garden, unusual things, so-called exotic things, exotic only because they are not ours. And this was the Chinese countryside, the Chinese forests, the Chinese anything, that because it's not domesticated there. And it occurred to me again and again, and I, you know, my big reference in the garden is Eden. That's the story of Eden, I think, is played again and again in the garden by everyone who gardens. And it occurred to me that that perhaps a metaphor for what I was looking at was was Eden banished to the four corners of the earth. You know, all these things that these plants men keep going around the globe. My friend Dan Hinckley does this. And as we were going through these places, there were things that they would decide was garden worthy. This was their term, garden worthy. And then there were things that were not garden worthy. And in fact, at one point, Dan came across something that he thought was a special rhubarb, a particular miniature rhubarb, the most small rhubarb ever. And he thought it was that, and he almost wept. And he collected seeds from it, and then later he realized, or he said he realized, that this was not the small rhubarb that he thought it was, but it was in fact a weedy polygonum, I think it was, or polygonatum. I always get those confused. And so the thing that had been just so treasured he almost wept over was cast out back into the wild. And it occurred to me that you perhaps have to be at a certain level of consciousness to appreciate even the weeds, to treasure even the weeds, even the thing that grows too rapidly, which is what a weed is. A weed is this very annoying thing that won't behave in a way you want it to. It has its own mind. It grows too readily. It destroys everything. That's a weed. But you had to have a special consciousness to think, well, it's okay to have the weed, the thing that behaves badly, and you can't just cast it out. And so I was very struck by that how perhaps this thing that we call nature was the garden turned out because we had all erred.
Well, it reminded me, as I read, of a line my friend Carol Eastman likes to quote, which goes, "All the way to paradise is paradise." And, you know, which is the suggestion that the world and its travails are paradise as well, had we the I to define it as such, but this paradise that you're talking about, which is all the way to paradise, includes other concepts that you've written about before. The concept of naming, in this case, the naming of plants, possession, in this case, the collecting of exotic things to bring to ownership in a garden. And so in small, within the world of the garden that you appreciate very much, there's a strange replica as well of the slave trade. And I, you know, it's very fascinating to watch you negotiate between something you very much enjoy and a system of metaphor which invokes the most terrifying thing for you.
Well, I think how it came to be that in the garden I would it would suggest all these thoughts to me, and how it came to be that in the garden I would try to negotiate, as you say, all of these ideas. I don't know, but it was in the garden while starting a garden that I came upon all these ideas. While digging a hole, while rooting out things, I. For instance, from that came my great interest in Thomas Jefferson, from his garden. And then I began to think about all the things that were a bane to people. For instance, the breadfruit in the West Indies is history. It came on, Captain Bligh's ship, was sent to the West Indies to feed slaves, and how no child I've ever met from the West Indies has ever liked breadfruit, as if they instinctively know that this fruit is connected to the deep horror that's involved with their ancestral consciousness. All of it, everything I read, you know, would just lead to the garden. I would be in the garden. Well, I went to the Garden Museum in England, and lo and behold, in its garden, outside the building, is the tomb of Captain Bligh, along with the Tradescants, and they were the first plants people. So everything, after a while, everything would just converge. It's like when you're pregnant and you see everybody, you think, oh, everybody's pregnant. But suddenly I thought, everything is the garden. Everywhere I went, there was the garden, and it said something to me.
I'm speaking to Jamaica Kincaid. You're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and the book is My Garden Book, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. As I was listening to you lecture recently, you were speaking about Jefferson, his treatment of his slave, Jupiter. And as I was listening, I felt a wash of horrible shame. Shame to be a part of a species among whom such a thing had happened. And I noticed as I was sitting listening to you that there was an enormous, almost supernatural rustling of papers, coughing, shifting of legs, as if to create enough sound to blot out the shaming.
Yes.
As if the solution to shame were not to hear the shamer.
Yes.
But I wondered, what is there to your mind, any atonement for shame?
Well, for this particular kind of shame, I think the atonement would be to bring this moment to an end, this moment of the African subjugation, humiliation, the despicable things done to them. And I say them because when I'm thinking about things, everything is them. It's not, I'm not thinking on my own behalf. My own individual behalf, but I am obviously them. But the way to atone for the shame is just simply to bring this moment to an end, and it's not brought to an end. I think, in a way, the rustling and the discomfort is that we don't know how to bring it to an end.
Well, the reason I bring this up in the midst of a discussion of the book My Garden book by my guest Jamaica Kincaid is that as the book continues its meditation and its building of subsets of metaphor, of those parts of gardening that repeat the ownership of the world, the trade and transfer of the exotic, the banishing and manipulating, the determination of what and who is to be the outcast, there's the gradual suggestion that in gardening you have found not a solution, but some sort of activity that helps to codify and make understandable the world of shame and shaming that you've spoken of in your other books.
Yes, and well, I should say that in the world of the garden, I found an explanation, partly an explanation of human existence, that human beings, the garden is not separate from human existence. In fact, they go along, they go hand in hand. So when I start to talk about it was in the garden that I discovered Jefferson and his relationship to this particular human being, Jupiter, and therefore Jupiter's descendants and their position. It's not at all separate. Jefferson, of course, being a great gardener, a great horticulturalist, as well as a very good farmer. In the first entry he makes in his garden book, a book that starts out with this sentence, I think he records that the hyacinths are blooming. That's the first thing in the book, the first entry. But then the book goes on to not only noting horticultural interest and his agricultural enterprise, but also how much each slave needed to eat, how much yards of cloth, how many yards of cloth they needed. This is in a book called The Garden Book, a recording of their births and deaths and so on and so forth. This is in a garden book, so I think he got it right, that the garden, his garden book, would include all that supported him and all that supports a garden. A garden is a very interesting development in human history. Human beings have agriculture first, and when they have enough agriculture, then they get horticulture. And horticulture is the isolating of things grown just for their beauty. But he got it right when he included the supporting qualities of horticulture, which was tobacco and so on and so on, and the people who helped his estate run, and the people and what they needed to wear and eat. He got it right when he made his whole world, the whole world that sustained him, a part of his garden book. We tend to not do that anymore. We think, oh, I go into the garden to lose myself. But that's a disservice to the garden. The garden is, in fact, one of the most active places for one to be in. It's an active, very, very active place for the mind, if you let it. It's not a salve. It's the opposite of a salve.
Well, what I learned in reading this book, and, you know, and my way of applying morals derived from smaller issues to the larger and then the larger still. What seems to go on here is that you say what happens in the garden, however much one would like it not to be sometimes, is temporary and transitional. Winter, although we don't want it to, will come, and winter, although we fear it won't, will also leave.
Yes.
And one's favorite plant, which is at the center, as you suggest, God's favorite plant was at the center of the Garden of Eden.
Yes.
This will no longer be our favorite plant. And what was central will be peripheral, and what was a garden will be the wild,
yes,
and what was wild will be domesticated.
The garden, yes.
The suggestion begins to be that as long as we understand that the definition that history brought, that at this moment these were slaves, was the definition of that moment, that the bitterness of having to maintain an inflexibility of bringing old definitions determined by a temporary economy and state of the world is not, in a sense, to live in the garden which refuses anything but flux.
That's right. The garden is not fixed. That's absolutely right. And in that way, I think it really is more and more I see that it's really an apt metaphor for how we are, how we live, how for life, really, and for time, that it is not fixed. I am convinced that what happened, I mean, somewhat convinced that what happened between God and Adam and Eve is that he got tired of them and the whole garden and didn't like the tree of life being in the middle or the tree of knowledge coming. Didn't like the whole arrangement and said, oh, I'll start next year. But we don't know what happened afterwards. But if you look at God as a garden, you can just see, oh, it's just very it was very temperamental, really. The whole thing is very temperamental. Just, I'm tired of them now. You get tired of the whole thing, a gardener does. I mean, the whole story of Eden is just such a story of the imperial, impetuous gardener. I find the garden just to be that, constantly a metaphor for how we are in the world. It is not fixed. It does die when the gardener dies. When you go to gardens that are being kept up, that were made by someone substantial, like Monet's garden or Sissinghurst, you really get the point that the garden has died and that it's now in another state of existence, being kept up by people of goodwill, and they should be kept up. You know, these important gardens, though you also feel every garden should be kept up. These just happen to be the lucky ones. But there's also something essentially dead about them. And you're not sure, really, that they shouldn't have been allowed to die. And I think it's in this way. Gardeners are always arguing, sometimes very self-important gardeners are always arguing that gardening is an art. But if it is an art, it's not an art in the same way that painting or sculpture is. It's really the most ungrateful of the arts. It will just go, and it doesn't respect anyone, really. You know, the minute the people turn their backs on Sissinghurst, it will just go. It really will just go. That's what a weed does. It comes in. The unwanted comes in.
Well, one of the things that so interested me in this conflux subject of slavery and gardening. As you spoke the other night, I thought of all of the time that I learned that at Passover it is the unperceptive son. What happened when you were enslaved in Egypt? But the wise son says, what happened when we were slaves in the house of bondage?
Mm.
That there's not a point at which this happened to you, the generations before. This happened to us.
Yes.
And I began to think about the difference between the fruit metaphor, the Garden of Eden, from which Adam and Eve are banished to live a life of sweat, and the stone metaphor, the pyramids, from which the children of Israel leave to go, ideally, to a promised land, not the Garden of Eden, but that somehow the economy of cotton and stone, of city and history,
yes,
versus the transitoriness of things built on the earth that can be burned or leave it, monuments. All these things became very vast for me when I began to see it in this pattern of human culture that included me, not what was done to you, but what was
absolutely
done to us.
Yes, because we are all so capable of doing it to each other. Yes, that's something that people who have things done to them often forget, that they are quite capable of doing too. And it might temper, the reason I think they forget it willfully is because it might temper, vengeance. But we're all quite capable of inflicting on each other all of these things. But it is interesting that you think of cotton and the pyramids. I mean, you're quite right. One is they're all, monuments to various civilizations.
Yes, and what they set their slaves to work on.
Oh, yes, so all to fulfill their own vanity. I mean, that's the thing about dominion over another person. It satisfies your vanity. What could be better than having complete control over another person? And in this way, whenever you feel, if you feel like that, you might just buy a plant. A plant is a most benign, a most benign thing to have complete control over, because ultimately it belongs to God and is loaned to you. You can do as you like with it, and it doesn't really cause much harm, unless you, it doesn't cause much harm. But the other thing that I've, since we're on this particular kind of subject, it's almost impossible to have the culture of gardening without civilization, and civilization always involves, you can't have a civilization without having, slaves or some kind of people who are in despair about their own life. And it might be a useful thing to understand that you can't have civilization without great pain, because maybe the people you're about to inflict the great pain on might feel a little better knowing they are contributing to this thing called civilization. If Jefferson and his cohorts had said to the African, listen, I know this is terrible, but you're making this thing called American civilization, they might have felt a little better about it.
Do you think so?
No. But you might have tried.
I've been speaking to Jamaica Kincaid upon the occasion of the publication of my garden book, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Jamaica, it's a pleasure to see you again.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse, Bob Cobb.